This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. We are continuing today with our conversations with a very wonderful Tim Lynch. Halfway through, two-thirds of the way through his doctorate.
Two-thirds, yep.
Is talking to people, firstly about anger and now hope, and then he's going to go on to something
action.
Else. Action.
Action. And that's when I talk about all the stuff that I'm doing. All the stuff that I'm doing, rather than the stuff that I'm talking to other people about what they're doing. It'll be all about me. However...
But we're taking a left... Or rather a right, I think. Well, maybe not.
Well,
direction today.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a right turn. Turned out it was actually more on the left than I initially thought it was going to be. So I got hold of Bryce, who's one of the founding members of Groundswell. And for those who don't know who Groundswell are the guys that advocate on behalf of farmers and like to drive their tractors through cities and stuff like that and slow things down and generally in protest. My assumption, Sam... was that he was going to be on the right side of the political spectrum.
Hey, I'm Bryce McKenzie. I'm a, I wouldn't say retired, but I'm certainly slowing down sheep and beef farmer, now dairy farmer, from Pomahaka and West Otago. I'm a very avid fly fisherman, so to me, clean water is... And clear water is something that I've always appreciated. So I was a founding member of the local water care group. Two of us basically started it off and then set up a committee, and now it's one of the most recognised water groups in New Zealand. We speak all over New Zealand. So we've spent a lot of time in turning around a waterway that was deemed one of the... not the most pristine waters in Otago, so we spent a lot of time working on that. And because of that, we built up quite a number of people in our water care group. And when the Labor government was looking at doing the national policy statement on fresh water, they inquired whether our group would be interested in doing a submission. And we did, and we had over 100 people at a meeting where we formulated a submission to the Labor government, quite an extensive submission, and they assured us that it would be listened to. And we thought that we were reasonably hard in areas that people wouldn't have been used to, as in to do with protecting waterways. And we sent our submission off, and what came back was completely over the top of what we had submitted and what most people had submitted on. And it was that far over the top, it actually couldn't work. It actually wouldn't work. It was impossible to do because it included sowing dates for pastures and things like that. But having farmed the land my whole life, I knew jolly well that getting young grass sown in paddocks on the 1st of September was just an absolute fallacy. It could never work because the ground was too wet to actually get it dried out and get tractors on it. So from that, I guess I was pretty irate, and I complained to my wife about it, and she said, well, you better do something about it then. So I said, well, I don't know what I can do. And he said, well, why don't you just do a Facebook post, which I did. Not being very good on Facebook, I wrote out a post and I posted it online. Within about 2 minutes, I had a phone call from an influencer on Facebook who had seen it and wanted to share it. So I said, that's fine, you go ahead. But she said, well, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? She said, well, I don't know, but I don't think you've made it public, which I knew nothing about. I said, well, how do I change that? So she talked me through going through my settings and changing it. And from there, it went viral, and it was deemed to have been seen by about 1.5 million people. It got something like nearly 5,000 people shared it. So it went viral, and people agreed with me. So from there, we decided to do a small protest in our local town, and I just organised it on Facebook, and who is now a co-founder with me, Laurie Patterson, he contacted me and said, well, he'd come with me. And so we drove to our local town in Gore, and there was over 100 tractors turned up in our local towns, which was absolutely amazing for nothing actually being organised as such. And from there, we formed a group, and we called it Groundswell NZ. Yeah, when I saw the water tests of our local river, that was my tipping moment. I went to a thing that was put on by New Zealand Land Care Trust and several other interested parties, and there was only three of us turned up. But it was very, very informative, and it was then that I realised that we had a problem with our local river. So that was back in about 2018, I think it was. So from there, we formed a water care group to try and do something about it.
Do you think there's like this sort of a disconnect, or do you think what's New Zealand getting wrong about rural life and farming values if something came back that was so unmanageable?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. I think that the lack of consultation with grassroots farmers would be part of it. It's just a breakdown in communication with those people that are working on the land and doing these things.
What did Groundswell tap into with the farmers?
I don't know whether it was just tapped into farmers. I think it tapped into a lot of people, because at that stage I think people felt that they were losing their rights to speak, that there was a control coming over people. They felt muzzled. So I think the fact that I had done something so ludicrous as question the whole policy of a government, I think it hit a note with a lot of people, not just farmers. Looking back, I think they realised that here was somebody that was actually prepared to speak out about what a government was doing.
Economically, well, particularly in the urban environments, we're not doing so well, and there's been this sort of talk of New Zealand's got almost two economies running parallel at the moment. Do you think like the rural economy understands the urban economy and vice versa?
I think there's probably a greater degree of understanding from urban towards what's happening. From rural to what's happening in urban. I don't know that. I think there's a lot of urban people still think that farmers are raping the land for their own benefit. I don't think they truly understand how farming dynamics have shifted a lot in the last, I would say, 8 to 10 years, where farmers have become very aware of what damage they can do and ways to mitigate it. For myself, I can tell you 100% that, you know, I had some really light bulb moments through working with Landcare Trust and other ones on you know, sedimentation and fertility runoff and things like this that I had never even considered. And I mean, at that stage, I was getting on in life. So, you know, my generation comes through an incentivized production regime where every government wanted you to produce more. And then all of a sudden that, and not only stop, it reversed. It was saying, no, what you're doing is destroying the planet. You need to reverse and go backwards, which is a massive mindset for people of my generation.
you know, there's some pretty horrible mental health statistics that come out of particularly places like Australia and the outback. Do we have a similar problem with mental health with farmers in New Zealand?
Oh, yeah, we certainly do. That's a major problem. You know, you don't have to go far to hear of people that have had severe run-ins with mental health. Is it higher than anywhere else? I'm talking about other occupations. It possibly is, but as I say, you know, I found when I was younger that the weather during lambing or calving or something like that had a bigger effect on my mental health than anything else that was ever going on in my life, because you're watching animals die, and you know, that's really hard for all sorts of reasons, just due to a snowstorm or, you know, a change in the weather. And to have activists blaming you for what was happening, I mean, that's really hard to take. I mean, you're almost trying to cover up what's happening because you can't handle the heat that's coming on from outside your occupation. So, yeah, and that's mentally challenging. It really is.
What does support look like in that respect?
Oh, gee, there's a guy, Craig Wiggins, who started Lean on a Gate, Talk to a Mate. Even that doesn't always work.
I mean, Groundswell has spoken pretty strongly about regulation. Is your issue with the amount of regulation, the type of regulation, or the way that it's implemented?
Yeah, all three in a way. What happens is government can often set something as bottom limits or targets, and then your regional councils could step in and override that and make it harder. So implementation, if you get somebody's having a bad day in their workplace and they're going on a farm to do an inspection, can cause severe repercussions for that farmer who may not necessarily intentionally have been doing something wrong, but he is doing something wrong in the eyes of the inspector. So implementation can be quite serious. So, yeah, all those things do affect it. And I know this personally because our Watercare group, we set up a best practice response team, which I head and have done since its inception. It was an idea that I had, and it works extremely well. So we have a hotline. People ring the hotline, then I get the call out. I don't run the hotline, but I'm the first contact. And I take people with me and we go in and investigate why there's been a breach of best practice. And I can honestly say in all the visits I've done to farms that there's one person that I thought, this person is just being totally negligent and couldn't give a stuff. The rest of them, there were some family issues, there was breakdowns, I'm talking about machinery breakdown, or there was normally, you just felt sorry for them and wanted to get out and help them correct the mistake, and they felt as guilty as about somebody had seen the mistake they had made. So by and large, I've learned that farmers are very, very respectful of the situation they're in. So you've got to watch when you're dealing with people in that situation. Once again, the mental health thing comes into it too. You know, they start feeling guilty because somebody sees they're not worthy or deems they're not worthy, and why did they ring us? And, you know, so it's quite interesting when you just sit impartially and watch what can happen.
Let's take a mental health break. Let's have a song.
It's interesting, that mental health thing. It's everywhere, really, isn't it? Glastonbury's been on, Sam, harking back to your country land. I'm not sure if you sit on and watch it on BBC or anything like that, but there's been a bit of controversy this time, more so than there has in the past, particularly surrounding the conflict in Palestine, etc. Now, a lot of the protesting surround a band called Kneecap, which the Prime Minister said he didn't want to have play. They're an Irish hip-hop band, for those that don't know, and they've played in New Zealand. Friends of mine went and saw them, said they were very good. They did play, but the BBC pulled the pin on them being broadcast because of their message. Now, there was a guy on before them called Bob Villain, Bob Villain is a two-piece punk outfit, very, very outspoken. He's subsequently had his visa removed from him to go to the Auckland because of the chant that he's led saying death, death to the IDF. See into that what you will. However, it will be irresponsible to play either of those bands, so I think what we'll do is we will play an outfit called Kim Kadichi, who just happens to have Bob Villain on it. So this is Kim Kadichi with Bob Villain and New England.
Welcome to the new world, the New England. Come witness the greatness of Britain. Driving around in a German car. Stop for lunch in a sushi bar. Get my news from the Daily Star. Get my kids from the tits and asses. Never mind about social classes. I'll cast my vote regardless. Is it you can't change? All that you want change. Is it you can't change? All that you want change. Welcome to the new world, the new England. All heroes, no villains. Double-decker bus and a bowler hat. Bob the Builder, Postman Pat. Social change, no I don't want that. Just sitting eating crisps in my one-bed apartment. Politics, that's not my department. But I'll cast my vote regardless. Is it you can't change? Such a fool, Britannia. Britannia fooled again. Britannia, you're so vain. You've gone insane cause you've been fooled. Britannia. Britannia fooled again. Britannia, you're so strange. You've gone insane. Welcome to the new world, the new normal. Look at us, queuing up, so formal. Sunday roast, God save the Queen. Man United with the bootcut jeans. In my pocket, no, I'm not too keen. That's why I keep over the rich and heartless. Bored of all these moaning artists. So I'll cast my vote regardless. Is it you can't change? All that you won't change. Is it you can't change? All that you won't change. You're such a fool, Britannia. Britannia fooled again. Britannia, you're so vain. You've gone insane cause you've been fooled.
Breathing up the air, huffing and puffing like they just run up the stairs. Fighting and cussing like they haven't got a care, but they care about everything that happens over here. Not over there, they couldn't give a toss. If it's a brown country, they steal all the crops. Blow it to smithereens and let the bombs drop. Then they cry about the boys when they try and come across. So gosh, I think this place is going nutty. Too much priceless British bacon butties. Worry about your neighbours and worry about the druggies. And not the eating graduate that's taking all your money. It seems they're taking a piss. Not blaming the brown fella, it's hard to resist. You with the thought that the nation is smarter than this. But I've got a couple questions, please answer me this. Is it you can't change? All that you won't change. Is it you can't change? All that you won't change. You're such a fool, Britannia. Britannia fooled again. Britannia, you're so vain. You've gone insane cause you've been fooled. Britannia. Britannia fooled again. Britannia, you're so strange. You've gone insane. You ain't shot them out, you just locked us in. You ain't shot them out, you just locked us in. You ain't shot them out, you just locked us in. You ain't shot them out, you just locked us in. You ain't shot them out, you just locked us in. You ain't shot them out, you just locked us in.
Is there any, can you think of any sort of examples of that regulation where it's been, oh, well, this is not going to work, this is not feasible?
Well, as I've said, the one that there was initially in the National Policy Statement on fresh water was to do with pugging paddocks. Now, that's just hoof prints on paddocks. And, you know, when you looked at it, it made every farmer actually... So they were going to be doing something illegal, because if you get an extreme rain event and you get a cold snap with it, animals move and they move to where the shelter is or where they're best protected, and then they mill. They just mill around because the ones on the outside get cold, so they want to get in the middle and so it goes on. So within a few hours, you have something that's completely was grass or was crop, and all of a sudden it's mud. So it put every farmer in the position of breaking that regulation and making them a villain. So that is one that really stood out to me. Even, you know, around water troughs, the nature of water troughs are that bullcocks get broken, water escapes. But if that happens, then and cattle or sheep or whatever started muddying around it, then same thing, you were a villain. So, you know, just some things would not work and just didn't work. And thank goodness they've changed them. Also, we've got... they did the whole of New Zealand in slope maps, which was absolutely ridiculous because it was nothing like the slope maps done by satellite. Didn't equate to the actual slopes on farmland. So you could be deemed to be breaking a law because you had your cattle on a slope over 10 degrees in slope, when actually it wasn't. So there was all these stupid jolly things that, and we all know different land types. Some of them are quite stable. At 20 degrees, you're not going to do any shifting of them. Some of the best wintering country in New Zealand would be over 20 degrees. And it's more stable than some at 5 degrees. It gave no... there was no discrepancies in the rulings for land types or anything like that.
So for someone who lives in a rural environment, can you sort of explain to me, talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old, but what's the issue with pugging? What was the concern surrounding it?
Well, of course, the minute you break grass open and expose soil, you run the risk of contaminants. In other words, you lose soil. And once you start losing soil, it's the simplest way to put it, the likes of phosphorus and things like that, particularly phosphorus, attaches itself to soil. So you lose soil that goes into a waterway. You're contaminating your waterway with phosphorus. And, I mean, nobody's disputing any of these facts, but there's other more practical ways of stopping that. And one of them is a buffer zone. So in groundswell, we always talk about mitigation. So in other words, you can't stop some of these happening because it's reliant on climate. So you just can't stop sediments running into waterways, but you can mitigate it. In other words, you can get nice buffer zones so that the water is filtered before it reaches the waterways. You can build sediment traps, which we do a lot of, which means that the water goes from flowing to almost stopping. And, of course, when it stops, the sediment falls out. So you're catching it in a bund. And there's things like that that we've done lots of trials on, and they work really well. So we talk a lot about, you know, mitigating the problem.
Do you think if we look back, you know, we can trace a lot of this stuff back to like 1987, you know, when farmers were told you need to be as most efficient as you can, and so farmers did. They became the most efficient farmers in the world at a massive cost, both environmentally, mentally, a whole lot of other considerations.
That certainly would have gone back to then. As I said before, that you know, I went through that era of being incentivised and encouraged to actually turn every piece of my farm into productive farmland, to drain every swamp, to work up every gully full of tussocks. I was encouraged to do that, incentivised to do it. So now we've been establishing wetlands. We've been letting our natural tussock country and gullies come back and flourish again because of the way it can take out sediment. So, yeah, there's been a lot of reversals, and a lot of it is good. A lot of it is really good.
Do farmers get rewarded financially for that?
No, not at all. In fact, it costs us financially because it doesn't become as productive. Once you take it out of grassland and let tussock country or rushes, carrick sectors or something grow in that area, it becomes non-productive in a way. And some of our gullies are planted in trees. So that country's all stuff that you can't do anything with. It actually has a cost to you.
Let's interrupt with another song. Who have we got?
Okay, let's carry on with the British theme. And it's funny, listening to this guy, like there's an emotional component to whenever I listen to Joe Strummer, whether it's in The Clash or whether it's him on his own. So I thought we'd go for Joe Strummer playing on his own or with his backing band, and the song's called Get Down Moses.
Tim Lynch, who's bringing us his conversation with one of the founders of Groundswell, Bryce McKenzie. There's a sentence I didn't think I'd be saying.
Neither did I, but there you go. Doctor, it's a funny thing, isn't it?
So far he's sounding quite reasonable.
He is a very reasonable man. He's a very considered reasonable man. And I think a lot of the things that he puts forward are... resonate with me, and the fact that what he's trying to do is have dialogue. He's trying to have a dialogue between parties outside of the political system and make things intergenerational, which in a lot of ways seems quite sensible, really.
And what you were saying before about the reversal of policies about draining the swamp or developing all the high country and that sort of stuff seem eminently sensible.
They all resonate with me, and I didn't pick that. When I was doing the research for this, I came up with a few of the points where I thought, okay, they make sense. But in as this conversation went on, I was like, well, I can see where you're coming from. One of the points that he doesn't say in here which is an example of this, is he talks about the inherent bias that food producers in New Zealand have against them, and that the carbon footprint of the food is calculated not from the point of production, but from when it enters the country. So if you get an apple that comes from Europe, say, to New Zealand, the carbon weight of it is calculated from when it's in New Zealand and not from when it leaves Europe. So the point that he's trying to make is that all food producers in New Zealand are at a competitive advantage under this current system. And, well, I have to agree with that. New Zealand can't compete with China in food production. And if you look at a lot of our major food producers, they are owned by Chinese companies.
Do you think, like, one of the issues that we have is that New Zealand's current sort of carbon accounting methods, do you think they fairly represent the emissions profile of food systems in New Zealand?
That's a difficult one because, you know, just the fact that NIWA within the last week or so has all of a sudden said, goodness gracious me, we've got this massive sump or sink in South Westland that seems to be absorbing all of our carbon. So, you know, we haven't, the science is just moving all the time. It's really scary to think that we could go and, you know, in the past we've looked at and thought, well, we could plant the whole country in trees and in 30 years' time everybody go, well, now we've got no food and nobody wants the trees, what do we do? Because that's the type of situation we're getting ourselves into. We go hell's bells into everything and then find out later that really, what was it all about?
Do you think that, you know, that sort of you just described, that the moving target of carbon calculation, is this why you object to the Paris Accord?
Yeah, in a nutshell, that is why we object to it. You know, we're just, and a lot, there's more things coming out attached to the Paris Accord all the time. And the fact that we're planting trees was originally part of, or it still is part of the Paris Agreement. So, you know, will we get enough people wanting to pull out? We probably will. Will the government do it? I doubt it. But it may open the door for renegotiation because, after all, it is an agreement and it can be negotiated. And let's just, you know, the main thing, and I was going to refer to it later on, but, you know, Article 2.1b of the Paris Accord actually states that food production should not be affected by in search of emissions, a reduction in emissions. So, you know, everybody forgets that that is a very important clause in that agreement. And we've seen massive decreases in food production in New Zealand in the pursuit of planting trees.
Do you think the carbon calculation, et cetera, which is going on in New Zealand, and this is, you know, the notion of carbon calculation is let's consider it for the moment to be a global thing that everyone is doing. Do you think it is putting New Zealand food producers at a disadvantage?
Yeah, I do. Well, I think it's putting New Zealand at a disadvantage simply because the minute you start talking carbon, you then go to methane and then you go to ruminants. So the one thing that New Zealand's economy is based on is farming, and most of that is done with ruminants. So it definitely puts New Zealand at a disadvantage in the world for the thing that we do best. And the thing that we're actually made to do, I mean, there's very few places in the world that have a climate, have soil types that can sustain what we do.
Are we at peak agriculture? Can we sustain what we're doing?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest question that we all have to face. I'm sure there's a lot of production left in New Zealand. I'm not sure whether that's good for New Zealand, though. That's certainly, you know, this present government talking about doubling export returns or doubling returns for agriculture, I think that can happen without doubling production, and that's their aim, of course. But, you know, now you got a social licence to increase production? At this stage, no.
I mean, one of the things particularly surrounding carbon at the moment is this, is offsetting, you know, planting a tree to absorb sequestered carbon. What are your views on the rise of, you know, pine plantations for offsetting, you know, particularly in productive land?
Oh, no, I mean, I've always been dead against it, and so has Groundswell, simply because that's destroying community, it's taking away people's livelihoods, it's especially carbon production, forestry, because once the carbon credits run out, what's the chances of those people doing anything with that forestry? The chances are they're going to walk away and leave it to the taxpayer of New Zealand to sort out. It's a really scary option going forward. Goodness me, I'm pleased I'm not going to be here in 30 years' time to see what's going to happen. And not only that, and most people don't consider it, but if you're of the ilk that thinks that methane is a problem, the animals incurring in forestry is unbelievable. You would not believe how many deer, pigs, possums are springing up in those mostly unhunted areas, because there's too big a clash between, you know, safety and getting rid of the vermin, so-called vermin. So it's actually twofold. The ruminants are actually living in those areas and coming out at night eating grasslands. It's cutting production in so many different ways. And, you know, there's great, we hear people on the West Coast that tell us that, you know, a lot of those river valleys that were destocked because the cattle were ruining the river basins and knocking river banks down. Now it's just deer that are doing the same thing in bigger numbers. So, as you go through life, you find that there's more and more times that, in hindsight, things can go horribly wrong.
Hey, we'll move on to sort of finances and stuff. Green Investment Fund was set up to help businesses decarbonise. Have farmers been able to access that funding, or was there just a big disconnect there?
There's a reasonably big disconnect there. I can't say I've come across anybody that's got a decent amount of funds to do anything like that. I'm sure there probably are some, so I might be speaking out of turn. And I think farmers are really concerned that if they tap into some of those funds, then they're going to have somebody else tell them what they can actually do then, because there are caveats with those funds. So a lot of farmers aren't actually actively seeking to be part of getting those funds, because they don't want the bank saying, well, now you've got the funds, you can do this and you can do that. So are they working? I don't know of anybody that's making them work, but that's not to say that it mightn't be happening.
How do you reckon a mechanism for green funding for small and medium farms, how do you reckon that could work? Do you have an idea of?
The only idea I have, and it's interesting because we discussed this last night with some members of parliament, is, you know, there's a fine line. Catchment groups need funds. They need funds because they have things they want to do and they have ideas, so they need funds. So there's a way of funding projects, and you've got to be careful because wherever there's funds available, you get the vultures that know how to access them for their own good. And that's the big challenge. The big challenge is, how do you support a catchment group without the administrators taking the money because they're administering it? And how does it reach the grassroots where it's actually doing some good? So that's some challenges that the MPs have got that they're becoming well aware of. But I think that could be a good channel of green funds. Farm plans, I think they're something that is definitely coming. And I think there'd be a reason to actually assist in some ways with perhaps some more advanced farm plans if people want them. So, there's opportunities there to actually fund environmentally good projects.
For sure. So how do you think your members are at? Because, from an outsider looking in, I look at Groundswell and I go, oh, you must be right-wing. You must be on the right side of the political spectrum. But then you come out and you say, well, actually, you know what? There's a lot of policies from the Green Party we agree with.
Yes.
How does that respond with your members?
Oh, they're really jumpy. And you may have seen recently we put one of Steve Abel's, because we agreed entirely with what Steve had to say. And it's not the first time I've agreed with Steve either. But, you know, then you get the people that say, what the hang are you doing? You know, you suggesting we should be voting for them? And I've had to reply to someone saying, not suggesting that at all. All we're saying is if you can't recognise good policy from anybody, then, you know, you're getting around with blinkers on, aren't you? I always find Chris Hipkins good to talk to. I always do. And I mean, just because they're in the Labor Party, I mean, there's some really good people in the Labor Party. There's some really good people in all the parties. So we've got to watch, because we can put people in a box, and we don't want to take them out because then it mucks up how we think. But goodness gracious me, you know, that's so wrong. There's a lot of good people. They're in all different parties.
Absolutely. So if you were given the golden wand and you could redesign New Zealand's climate policy from scratch, what do you think it would look like from a farmer's perspective?
And this is something I did put a bit of thought into, actually. You know, first of all, there would have to be an open and frank discussion on the subject of climate, and that would have to be ongoing. In other words, any new science, any old science, anything, there would have to be, both sides of the story would have to be aired. And I think that hasn't been done well. I really do. I think that anybody that disagreed was put in a box, the boxes that we're talking about, and was a climate change denier or whatever. You know, we know some very good scientists in America who will talk about CO2, the effect it has, and most of their records, and they've kept records for years, will show that CO2 levels normally lift after warming takes place, not before. And we will bring some of these people out to New Zealand, because we think that that discussion still needs to be had so that everybody gets full understanding. And there'll be people that will say they've got it wrong, and that's good, and we should listen to them too. So that would be the first thing. I think we need to have open and frank discussions. And I think that science needs to be used to and become more accurate in actually understanding what is causing something, rather than us presuming that this is causing it or something else presuming is causing it. As I said, you know, we spent millions on putting the satellite over New Zealand to pick up our methane emissions, and it didn't find anything. So, but has that been talked about? Does anybody even discuss it? Like, it was big news when it started. Was there anything it even said when it finished? Not a thing. So, you know, we can't hide the things that don't suit the agenda or the rhetoric. We've got to be able to speak openly about everything. So that would be number two. And, of course, number three was that, as the clause that I quoted before, the 2-1-B from the Paris Accord, that if we're going to deal with emissions, let's deal with emissions, but let's not blame it on something that is producing food, unless we're absolutely positive that if by stopping that, we're going to make a change. Because if you starve the world, you haven't fixed the problem, you've created one.
So do you think New Zealand farmers can lead the way in sustainability and not just be regulated by it, or do you think there's just too much of an inherent tension there?
No, I honestly think farmers can lead the way in sustainability. And in a lot of ways, I think they're doing it. We've got to be sustainable. We have no choice, because if we're not sustainable, we're going to destroy what our livelihoods are based on. So I think farmers, by and large, are really conscious of being sustainable, and it's growing more and more all the time. That, you know, we always look at it here with our water care group, that, you know, one person doing, you know, everything they possibly can isn't actually going to change much. But if you get everybody conscious and just doing a little bit every day, in other words, if they think about how what they're doing is going to have an effect on our local waterway, if they only just think about that, they're already in a conscious state of actually trying to mitigate a problem. And that's all you need. So we try and get everybody just with that thought in mind as they start the day. And after that, it takes care of itself.
Mm. And I suppose in that way, it is actually increasing productivity at the same time.
Yes, it does, yeah. And it's amazing how many shortcuts there are if you actually stop and think about it. And, you know, for us, you know, we have electronic monitoring of our animals. So they're all, have you heard of Holter?
Yes.
And to us, it's the biggest saving we could ever have made, and in emissions as well, because we don't have vehicles running around our farm the way we used to. Nothing like it. Our bikes hardly ever get used because men very rarely go out there to do anything because it's all done electronically. So, you know, there's some magnificent, you know, sustainable farming things now that, and they cost a lot of money. Like, it costs us a blooming fortune, but there's some really good benefits come from it environmentally and also for staff. Our mental health of our staff is unbelievable. You know, a lot of their worries are gone. They arrive at work much later because the cow's already waiting for them when they get there. So, you know, that's an hour and a half longer in bed in the morning, and they're away home earlier because they don't have to take cows away. So, you know, it's a really good story. It really is. And there's technology.
The thing about the whole thing that I find really nice is this idea of a whole lot of being able to train a whole lot of cows. sounds fantastic. So
tell you what, it takes no time.
Yeah?
It takes no time at all. Less than a day.
Wow.
They're incredibly intelligent.
Oh, I'm going to eat my steak and cheese pie if you keep talking like that. So is this what keeps you hopeful?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
You're dead right. That's probably it in a nutshell. I see all the advances from when I was farming, see the technology and, you know, just the ability to measure things, to just gauge the differences is just phenomenal. Wish I had it.
So what does a fair and thriving rural New Zealand look like?
I mean, the first thing is mental health. If people are happy doing their job. I mean, I grew up farming and I was always happy doing it, but I watched my sons and saw some of the pressures they come under. And most people my age will tell you that a lot of the sons didn't want to go farming. They didn't want the what went with farming, the connotation of destroying the planet, those things. So if I could see rural New Zealand thriving and urban New Zealand thriving as well, but people happy in what they're doing, boy, that would be, you know, that would be just the way it should be.
if there's something you wish that urban New Zealand knew or understood more about the work that farmers do in rural New Zealand, what do you think it would be?
It would have to be that they'd have to take into consideration that farmers are at the beck and call of the climate and they can't control it and it affects them immensely. And they'd have to put themselves in that position to really understand that a lot of things that happen are not by the farmers doing, they're by circumstances that they can't control. That would be the one thing, just an understanding of that. I know, because I see it often, you know, urban people complaining, farmers are always complaining about the climate. And I guess they're right, and we need to stop doing that, but we only do it because it affects us so much.
Do you think, then, is there a version of New Zealand where climate justice and rural livelihoods can thrive together?
Yeah, I think there is. I think in order to get that, you have to take the extremism out of the discussion. And I don't know how you do that, but the thing is that it's all very well having this thought of pristineness. It's got to be, how do you get to there? And you don't just flick a switch and you're there. You're affecting thousands of people when you're doing it, and they have to buy into it and believe that it can be done. Otherwise, they're not even going to attempt it. So it's all very well having these goals. We just differ in a lot of ways how we're actually going to achieve them. But we need to talk.
Finishing that, telling us that we should be taking extremism out of the discussion and we need to talk.
There is an irony in that.
Which is all very well for them to say, driving tractors around the country and...
Part of the
movement that ended up in the occupation of Parliament.
Yeah, and some of those signs that were on the back of those utes were fairly unsavoury as well. It is interesting, though, how the position that he's taking is far more centrist than perhaps the people that are coming with him, if that makes sense.
So what does it tell us about hope?
What does it tell us about hope? Hope is a multi-headed beast, is what it tells us about hope. Hope is a remarkable emotion that allows us to travel or to move into something that we don't know the solution to. It also tells us that hope, without hope, we just have despair. And it's, I think, what he is providing in the form of hope is a way out of, well, what farmers may have considered a dark place, perhaps.
Do you think that they would have risen up if they hadn't got angry about the unworkable bits of the regulation, which seemed to me to be like almost a side issue? Some policy person just had a bit of overreach about one small component of it. The arguments about pugging seem quite, I mean, their take of the pugging one is it's quite small, it's in flooding situations or it's around the water troughs, it's not very much. But we all know, we can see paddocks that are completely pugged out.
Yeah. I sort of wonder within that whether the question was, if the question had to be reframed, was the issue around, you know, for example, pugging, was it because it was a top-down declaration that was being given to the farmers? If that was the actual issue, the farmers may be coming across and saying, well, actually, there are some issues that we just simply can't do anything about. We simply, you know, realistically, it's not realistic for us to be able to prevent pugging. It doesn't happen. We need rain. Without it, you know, we have nothing. We can't all live in sheds. So I wondered if that was actually part of that, was that the idea of it being a top-down declaration. I also wonder if there's a slight fear. When I was in China, I was talking to guys that are doing the MBA over there, and they were looking specifically at farms, and the farms were all inside. And the reason for that is because it allows the Chinese to control every single output from the cow, right down to the methane. They have no pugging. There is no waste. The urea, everything is controlled. Now, if you compare that to the pastoral farming model, which New Zealand really prides itself on, and to a point we should be proud of it, because it is a very efficient way of farming, if we look past the fact that it operates on monocultures, etc., but we don't have time for that at the moment. But it represents a particular way of life as well. And my feeling that I got from that is when you start getting these top-down governmental declarations, it's really impinging on people's identity and the way people view how they operate within the world. And it's when you start to sort of push into those areas of identity that you really start to get quite heavy pushback occurring. And, you know, we have seen that throughout all the conversations that I've been having, whether it's been on the side of the climate deniers or the climate protesters. It is still a form of identity protection.
Especially when you're already doing something which you are quite proud of, which is in the direction that those other players want you to be moving in. He talks with some pride about the best practice response group going out and helping the farmers, the few farmers in his view, perhaps, that, you know, do fall through the cracks. Let's help these farmers fix it. And it turns out to be that their tractor had broken down or something.
Yeah, and you can understand where he's coming from there. Because, I mean, like, you know, I give hundreds of lectures a year, hundreds of them. They're not all perfect. And if I had someone walk into me when I was giving a lecture and it wasn't perfect and I hadn't prepped properly, and I say, yeah, but it's the one out of the hundreds and hundreds that I give a year, and you're going at me for that one, I guess I would be upset about it as well. The problem is we have this tension in that if you start thinking of the ecological costs or, you know, true cost, New Zealanders all feel like we have an ownership towards, you know, our green spaces, if you will. You know, because we view them as being communities. So whenever we see something like pugging or something like that, we view it as a community cost, and we don't find it acceptable. And that's part of our identity, whether because we live in urban environments. So there is a tension within there, and I found it really interesting in that when I was asking, look, is it possible, is it possible within that tension for farmers to be stewards of the land, to kind of drive forward this idea of like a sustainable farming agricultural sector?
Lots for you to be thinking about.
Much. There is a lot there.
I think that the relationship between anger and hope is getting more and more tangled.
It is getting very more and more tangled, yes.
Who are we going out to?
All right, we're going to carry on with the British theme, and we're going to go out with the Prodigy and the very old song of theirs.
I got the poison, I got the remedy, I got the concept of rhythmical remedy. I got the poison, I got the remedy, I got the concept of rhythmical remedy. I got the poison, I got the remedy, I got the concept of rhythmical remedy. I got the poison, I got the remedy, I got the pressure.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. We have a broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. I've been talking with Tim Lynch, who has brought his surprisingly hopeful conversation with Bryce McKenzie. What's next week?
Wait and see, it's a surprise.
Next week, we will be surprised. I'm Samuel, back to Blowing Bubbles.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.